Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature segments from this week's shows. On Monday, July 1st, Joe is joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association Judy Patrick, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Here's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to talk about more the fallout from the debate performance on Thursday night by President Joe Biden and what has been going on over the weekend. Then
and the performance of Trump.
Well, of course, and the performance of Trump.
Thank you.
So the Democratic surrogates are out now. A lot of concern from Democratic operatives who said, "Oh my God, what is this? This isn't good." And then there was an article in Politico about how they had a meeting of the family at Camp David. The family is largely blaming the advisors, the four old white guys within the Biden orbit, who were getting him ready for the debate, of over prepping him and not prepping him properly. And then there are many in private saying that a change should be made at the top of the ticket. And then you have the media, the New York Times editorial board comes out and calls for Joe Biden to step away from the race. The New Yorker magazine and editor David Remnick calls for that. The Atlantic Journal-Constitution called for the president to step aside. And today, and over the weekend during the shows, people have said, "Well, that was, you can't base a performance on 90 minutes." And all I would like to say is, okay, but the 90 minutes was every rumor we have been hearing for the past year and a half. It was there before our eyes. The other thing, too, is that Nancy Pelosi used an interesting term, that we're speculating that he was distant. Well, we weren't speculating. We saw that with our own eyes. And then, while it sounds, perhaps, it may sound early, like I am on team get Biden off the ballot, I don't know what I think, because I don't know what the party is going to do. I have no idea what they would do. If Biden held a press conference in the next hour and said, "I'm leaving the race," well, good luck. I mean, what's going to happen?
Right.
Let us begin with the president of the United States, who I believe is still at Camp David. I think is supposed to be coming. There's also I just one more thing, and Judy, I think I'd like to hear your thoughts on this too. But we're now starting to hear reporting about the prep and reporting about why he was at Camp David for a week. And I think that it was really what people were concerned about, is that I think the Washington Post reported it as being bewildering to a lot of the Biden team, because they had him ready, they had his answers, and then when it came time for him to actually say them, he was unable to do that.
Right. He was secluded at Camp David for a week and not doing all this prep. And, is, you know, we had this vision of him resting up and getting, you know, working the camera angles. And my initial reaction was, oh, he was just overprepped, or he was overbooked. And let's blame all the people around him. You know, the bottom line is the only person really to blame for what happened on Thursday night is Joe Biden. Let's have some straight talk here. The man cannot defeat Donald Trump. The happiest person in the land today is Donald Trump. And you can tell by the fact that he's really not going on the attack on Trump or on Biden at all. He's attacking the policy, but he's really not. You know, I was expecting some cruel tweets from him, but he's backed off a little bit, because you know why? Because he wants Biden, because he knows he can beat Biden. I think Biden owes it to the country to step aside.
I agree with most of what you just said. The only thing I would add is I'm going to go to what Judith Inc., our panelist on Friday, was talking about of this, of those who are around him, and the political malpractice was the term she used, of saying, look, 2 years ago saying you're ready to run, but also painting a picture that he was much more or is much more engaged than he is or can be at certain times.
Right. And you saw this campaign against any media outlet that dared question his acuity or his ability to walk down a ramp. It was relentless, especially against the New York Times. We have seen stories come out about his interviews and how he falters in it. And, you know, the fact that Trump is such a horrible candidate, such a bad omen for our country going forward, makes it, you know, makes you want to believe them when they tell you that. But the truth came crashing down upon all of us. I mean, I talk to regular people who do not want Donald Trump to be president. And what they saw was just defying all their expectations. And they just, I mean, can you imagine going to this man in the event of aliens from outer space invading and getting the answers that he gave on Thursday night? It's just horrifying.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Florida, was on CNN this morning, and she said that, you know, the thing you don't understand is when I went to meet with the people in my district over the weekend, not one person was talking about his debate performance, which I think is interesting because I went to two graduation parties, and that's all anybody talked about was the debate. That was before hello.
And don't tell me it's a one-off.
Right. Yeah. Right. Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine people who are watching the debate who are just appalled by how poorly Biden performed deciding that they would therefore vote for Trump or not vote for Biden because he didn't perform well in a debate. Like, it is true he didn't perform well in the debate, but it is also true that we kind of all made our beds after January 6th and that there's one person who led an attempted insurrection and another person who just did not, right? There's one person who's a convicted criminal and one who is not. And like, he can perform poorly all day. There's no universe where I'm supporting the convicted criminal. Like,
Right. And I agree with you. And I think that's center to this debate. But the other thing too is that, the surrogates keep on saying that he's the comeback kid, and he's come back from before, he's come back from adversity, he's come back. And I don't want to ascribe any diagnosis. But if you are removed from that, that situation probably is not going, I mean, that's how aging works. That's not going to get better. So I think to just say it's a bad night and you're never going to see that again, I think is incredibly naive. If you want to stick with the guy, that's fine. But I think you should also prep and say, this is what you can expect.
But we did that last round, too. And Trump is not significantly younger than Biden. And you can read transcripts of Trump's comments, and they are nonsensical. They don't even have a theme most of the time. Like, sure, if you were listening to Biden's statements, he got most of the way through an argument and then sort of lost that end bit where he's trying to nail like a point. But Trump can't do that at all. Like, he swirls in nonsense.
Yes.
And lies.
Teresa.
So I agree that Biden's debate performance was unnerving at best. And you could, you know, I think the Biden team has acknowledged that, the Biden surrogates have acknowledged that you know, he had a bad night, had a bad day. And I think that needs to be addressed, and I think the Democrats need to take a little time to get an assessment of the situation and to see where they go forward, because it's complex. If they decide that he's going to step aside and somebody steps in, there's a whole series of process questions that happens. You can do it technically, but how you do it will determine whether or not, not only do you maybe, you know, can still win the presidency, but do you hold the House and the Senate? And so there have to be a lot of people in this conversation because you do not want a chaotic convention. Mm-mm. You want to, if indeed he decides that he's going to step aside, if the, he and the party and the family and everybody decides to step aside, you need a handoff to someone who you say, this is going to be our person, and the Black Caucus is behind it, and the Women's Caucus is behind it, and the Conservative Democratic Caucus is behind it, and the National Democratic Governors, everybody's got it behind it. It's not going into a convention and say, let five people speak and see what, you know, let's a toss-up. That can't happen. It has to be a process thing. Now, all the stories today in this last 24 hours about the family being there and upset with other people, you know, those are one-day stories. That's noise in the system. That's going to go away. You know, you know, that's not strategic. That's cathartic for all of those people who went and talked to reporters about stuff. But the bigger issue is, for me, not only, you know, yes, I don't object to the Times or others calling for Biden to step aside. What I do object to is Biden's performance was unnerving. Trump's performance was unhinged. He spoke in a firm voice, but listen to what he said. Mm-hmm. Listen to what he focused on. He focused on everything about himself, whether or not he was a good president, about whether, you know, the convictions and all of that. But they ask him about childcare, something that matters a lot in people's lives. He didn't answer about childcare. He blathered on about something else. Every time they asked him about a substantive issue, he either didn't or couldn't answer it. That's the problem.
I agree with you completely on that. However, I don't believe that you can say you have an existential threat in Donald Trump, which I think we do. We have an existential threat with Donald Trump. Got it. And then here's the guy to the right hand of the stage who is going to try to articulate the differences and to point it out.
What I'm saying,
and he was unable to do that.
What I'm saying is, where's the balance in terms of the scrutiny? There's no balance in terms of the scrutiny. And so you have all this echo chamber about how bad Biden was, but nothing about how bad Trump was. And I say
nothing about Trump's performance was surprising.
But just because it's baked in doesn't mean it's okay. Where's the New York Times saying Trump is unfit? Trump would not answer the fundamental
The New York Times has written extensively
but
about
I mean after this.
New York Times.
Why even the editorial calling for Biden to drop out talked about the fact that Trump was unfit. The problem
even in that editorial, Teresa, even in the New York Times editorial, they said if he remains in the race, we are going to endorse Joe Biden. Right. We were going to endorse Joe Biden.
Right.
However, we're at a point right now where we can make a decision.
But I think, I mean, when Trump would not answer the fundamental question about the peaceful transfer of power, he wouldn't answer it. That's disqualifying.
And if Joe Biden was the Joe Biden of
Saturday,
but of the State of the Union and other events, then yes, then that's probably exactly what we would have been focused on.
And I'm not saying now. I mean, I personally think I would like to see Senator Mark Kelly, astronaut, veteran, decorated veteran from a key swing state, have Biden continue to campaign around the country, but have a handoff. Everybody agrees on somebody, Senator Mark Kelly, whether he wants to, whether the party wants to, whatever. But I'm not saying that I don't think that there's a scenario in which that Biden should step aside, and I found that to be unnerving. I do think all this chatter about, well, they were hiding this. Well, Republicans went and talked to him, Republicans who hate him, and they acknowledged that they had perfectly fine conversations with him in the past. So I think that, you know, I think this is a serious problem, but I think it's a problem for democracy on both sides.
Let's go to a political consultant and see what they think.
I think everybody needs to calm down.
Yeah.
That's what I think. You know, I just came off of bruising primary. people can get so, their hair can get on fire so quick. Everyone just needs to calm down, take some time, take a beat or two, okay, and recognize that the only way, as you were saying, Teresa, the only way you can replace Biden on the ballot is if the Democrats go into the convention in lockstep with a nominee decided upon, no brokered convention, no major hoo-ha on the floor, no nothing. It's got to be, okay, we have a problem, this is how we're going to fix it, and this is what we're going to do. And I don't see, given the state right now of the Democratic Party and foreign policy issues that are splintering the party, as well as internal, well, not internal, internal to the United States.
Domestic issues,
but internal, other kinds of parties that are inculcating themselves into the Democratic Party. I don't see that happening. I don't see them walking into Chicago with a unanimous vote for another candidate. So we just need to calm down. It was not a great night. I'll give everybody that. It sucked. Okay? There's no two ways about it. I was hoping for the Joe Biden of the State of the Union. We didn't get that.
Again,
the
with
next
a teleprompter,
day.
But go ahead.
Right. But the next day, he did much better. And he's a good campaigner and not a great debater. He admitted that he didn't do well. I remember watching in 2012, the debate, one of the debates, the first one between
Obama,
Mitt Romney and Obama.
Obama. Yeah.
And everybody went nuts,
right,
because Obama didn't do well in that debate, right?
But it wasn't about a poor debate performance.
It was about a poor debate performance.
It wasn't about that they weren't physically or mentally fit.
Well, we
to
don't
not
know.
Only be,
we don't
to
know
even
that.
Be in the debate, much less running the country.
We don't know that. We are all here, pundits,
right,
watching what we see on TV, seeing what we read in the newspapers, and making a conjecture from that. Okay, so Obama
well,
had a, no, 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 Joe. Let me finish. Obama
okay,
had
but
a bad.
We saw it with our own eyes.
I get that, but it's
but we also
not
saw
the
Trump
end of the
with
world,
our own eyes,
right?
And he's
right.
dangerous,
and he is dangerous. So it's like, you know, yes, it was bad. Okay, fine. Let's move forward. If the Democrats can agree on somebody else unanimously, great. That's not going to happen. We all need to stand by Joe Biden.
Libby Post on the Roundtable panel on Monday, July 1st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Tuesday, July 2nd, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
We know now, and we have much more insight into the decision, the Supreme Court's decision, to bestow presidents with immunity from prosecution over official actions is an extraordinary expansion of executive power that will reverberate long after Donald Trump is gone. But its immediate implications for the election subversion case against Mr. Trump and the prospect that he may feel less constrained by law if he returns to power, The ruling also adds to the nearly relentless rise of presidential power since the mid-20th century. It had seemed like a constitutional truism in recent years when more than one lower court opinion addressing novel legal issues raised by Mr. Trump's norm-breaking behavior observed that presidents are not kings. But suddenly, they do enjoy a kind of prerogative of a monarch. The relationship between the president and the people he serves has shifted, says Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing in the outraged dissent joined by the court's other two liberals, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. Dismissing those worries, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, argued that presidents stand apart from regular people, so protecting them from prosecution if they are accused of abusing their powers to commit official crimes is necessary. I'm going to need someone to explain that to me.
Well, there's a lawyer in the room.
Yes, that is good. Unlike anyone, he wrote, the president is a branch of government, and the Constitution vests in him sweeping powers and duties. He added, accounting for that reality, ensuring that the president may exercise those powers forcefully as the framers anticipated he would, does not place him above the law. It preserves the basic structure of the Constitution from which that law derives. But wait, this gets even more confusing. These dueling claims of what risk the founders meant the Constitution to guard against will take their place in the annals of a multi-generational argument over presidential partners. No president before Mr. Trump has been charged with committing crimes while president. That has raised the question of whether previous presidents were immune, and the Justice Department under President Biden broke a norm by allowing a special counsel to charge Mr. Trump, or whether it was just that most other presidents weren't criminals. After Richard Nixon resigned to avoid being impeached for his abuses of power and the Watergate scandal, his successor, Gerald Ford, shut down a criminal investigation into Nixon by pardoning him. The act was unpopular enough that it may have cost Ford the 1976 election. So there's a lot to talk about this morning, this public and private actions and what that means. There's a lot here. Three members of the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority, Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas, and Samuel Alito. So three of the six who voted in favor were Reagan administration lawyers. Two others, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, worked for the Bush administration and advanced a broad view of a president's exclusive constitutional powers, especially in the sort of national security matters that frequently arose after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Only Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a former law professor, never worked as a lawyer for the executive branch. Notably, even as she joined the majority opinion, she issued a more restrained concurrence, siding with the dissent on whether prosecutors should be at least be able to tell juries about a president's official actions if they are relevant context for understanding unofficial actions he is being prosecuted for.
I wish I could lend any insight other than I'm very interested in sort of the what I think is the majority's, you know, sort of lockstep adherence to what they believe the founders intended. And I think you saw that with the overturning of Chevron also. Although, again, I don't think that that decision or this decision are wildly absurd. But I think that they are sort of a reflection of the swinging of the pendulum that happens when you change the composition of the court. I think that there's a lot to be said about immunity for actions taken when a person is the president of the United States. Certainly there were calls for prosecution of other presidents, and most specifically I remember calls for prosecution of Bush after 9/11 and, you know, the invasion based on what turned out to be incorrect information. So it makes sense to me that a president acting within his presidential capacity would have some immunity from acts that, if another person were to take them, may be viewed as criminal. You need to have that kind of authority to lead, and they rightly point out he is the head of an entire branch of government. And hopefully it'll be a she someday that is the head of an entire branch of government. But all that being said, there's the saying, and I'm probably going to get it wrong, and please, you know, if someone wants to correct me, fine, have at it, but it's bad facts make bad law. You can take a factual scenario where this strict application of the law seems to result in a nonsensical outcome. And to me, that's, you know, you saw that right away with the Trump's lawyers trying to immediately set aside the verdict in New York, which were not presidential acts. I'm sorry. There's no, I mean, because he was running for president, it's okay to.
Well, they're saying the checks were written while he was president.
But I think that's just so tenuous. I mean, I don't know how the checks being written after he gets elected, because he delayed in paying the guy in a timely manner that he somehow enjoys, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. But again, bad facts make bad law. I doubt that they will set aside.
No, I doubt. I doubt they will too.
But it's fascinating, right? That you know, we've got these sort of strict constructionalists that are now dominating the Supreme Court, and you see what happens. There was an argument to be made that at the time that Roe, for example, was decided, that it was a large deviation from what was then the understanding of the Constitution and how the right to privacy applied, and that they were really going out on a limb. It stood for a very long period of time, but now there's this majority that is going back to strict constructionalists, and they are setting aside precedent and saying, no, this is what the Constitution says. This is what the framers intended. And so here's the outcome. And by the way, I think they went very much out of their way not to address the particulars of this case. They're saying in the abstract, this is what the rules ought to be.
So there was... I actually met Scalia once and heard him talk. I've heard other strict constructionists. You know, the problem is strict constructionism is equivalent to saying judicial activism pretending to be the framers' intent. So, for example, the Chevron is a much easier one to explain that, right? With the Chevron case, Congress passed a purposely broad law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, was the intention that would let the agencies make the decisions, or was the intention that, you know, judges would make the intention, right? Neither one of those is actually written in the law. So it becomes up to the judges in the Supreme Court to say, hey, you know, the Constitution doesn't explicitly say anything about this. We're going to interpret it this way because we think that's what the framers meant. Now, they could just as easily have said, we're going to interpret this other way, that breadth, right, was in the Constitution,
I will say
too.
It's inconsistent with a lot of the thinking that, you know, even in New York, and New York's Constitution is a little better, I think, in terms of basically controlling the executive authority, although, you know, we've slid backwards too. But I would say this. I mean, there's been a tension historically where regulatory agencies interpret their authority as being much broader than any reasonable person would interpret it.
Right. But now they're saying that the president gets to tell the executive agencies what to do, despite the fact that my understanding of the Constitution, which I admit is not as a constitutional lawyer, says we have these three branches of the government. So when Congress does something, the president can't unilaterally decide, no, we're just not going to do that.
Right.
This gives the president not only extends his powers the way they've been extending his power, but also makes him immune to the legality of that. So in other words, obstruction suddenly becomes almost impossible to prove.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean,
seems like it can't possibly be what the framers intended, because the framers said explicitly, you know, George Washington got up and said, "Hey, thank God we're no longer kings. You know, I'm right. Mr. President. I'm not His Majesty." And,
right.
You know, I feel like this is the Supreme Court saying, originalism doesn't include any of the amendments.
Well, you know, I
certainly
guess,
not the first time.
So, I mean, if you look at it in the context of the regulatory decision as well, they're saying, you know, the regulatory agencies are the province of the executive. It's the execution of the laws. If Congress wants to correct it, they can fix the law. They can clarify. They can direct. But then it begs the question, what happens when the agencies at the command of the executive don't obey or don't follow through on what they're being told to do? But this decision only extends to the right. president. It doesn't
well,
include...
And it also extends... Some of my concern has been less the deference to a strong president. I don't like that. But the court, which rallied heavily, a lot of these people on this court got there by saying we're against judicial activism, have given more and more power to the courts, and particularly to the Supreme Court, because now they become the ones who... So Congress passes a law. The president says we're going to do X. Congress comes back and says, hey, you know, we don't like X. It's now the Supreme Court who gets to say, well, X is or isn't constitutional. You know, if Congress passes a law, a national law either permitting or prohibiting abortion, you can see that going right back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and, I think judicial you know. Activism is in the eye of the beholder, right?
Yeah.
You know, is it activism to overturn 50 years of precedent? Arguably, yes. But their argument would be, well, no, it was the original decision was activism, and we're just correcting that. So, yeah. You know, there's some semantics involved.
The irony is that this decision comes just a couple days before we celebrate the 248th birthday of the United States, where the Declaration of Independence was officially issued. And really what that was a screed against the idea that a king could tell us what to do, and absolute power would no longer reign over us. And it just feels like, not so much these days. I mean, I read as much as I could of Sonia Sotomayor's dissent. I read also that she read it out loud, took 24 minutes, which is unusual. But I applaud her for that. I think it was, I mean, she had so many good lines in that, and it's worth it. I mean, I just can't believe that just about 4 or 5 days after the debate that was so disastrous for Biden, that seems like old news, and a lot has gone by since then. So many things have happened. It is perhaps one of the, I mean, this is reminiscent of what went on in August and late July of 1974, where one thing would happen, another thing would happen, another thing would happen.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. And it doesn't seem to be anywhere near an end. So we're left with trying to analyze what exactly this court ruling means. But we know one thing, it's really going to slow down, if not put the brakes on, the federal prosecution of Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th uprising. And there may be one little, you know, some legal analysts have written that there might be one light at the end of the tunnel in order to argue back before Judge Chunkin. Is that how
yes.
she pronounces her name? Who handles the Washington-based case involving January 6th, where Trump has been charged. Prosecutors will have to reveal a lot of details that have never been detailed before in making their case that his actions were not official acts. And in the process, in the next several weeks and maybe next few months, if that comes out, one might think that could be hurtful to Trump, but he does seem to be, you know, made out of, you know, Teflon these days, and things don't stick to him. But it's a very uncertain time, and it's unsettling, and clarity is not in the offing.
And also, Mike, you know, the one of the things I heard, you know, part of the problem is there's still everybody's trying to interpret this thing. It's 130 pages long and full of. I was told there's some places where there may be considered inconsistencies depending on legal interpretation. But my understanding is Trumkin's court, that's not going to be made public because it could be official acts. So they're saying that will have to be something where the prosecutors report to her.
Right, have it in camera. It's in camera, so
yes,
closed
it's
courtroom.
In camera.
Yeah. Or in the
judge's
chambers.
It may still get out, but it's not going to be. Anyway.
Well, if she rules that that is compelling evidence, then perhaps that evidence become part of the record. But there's just so many. So many things happening at once it's going to take a little time to sort all this out exactly what it will mean. But I'm sure it will. I think everybody agrees that January 6th trial in Washington involving Trump ain't going to happen anytime soon. And if Trump is elected to another term, he'll have the authority, clearly now, in case there was any question, to order the Justice Department just to end that whole process.
Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, July 2nd. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, July 3rd, Joe Donahue was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
The New York Times reporting this morning, and I think it is an interesting story for several reasons. One, it has four bylines to it, and these are four of the top writers for the New York Times: Peter Baker, David Senger, Zolan Zana-Youngs, and Katie Rogers, and all have been reporting at various times and various events of their interactions with their sources as to the health and welfare of the President of the United States. So this report, which dropped late yesterday afternoon, I'll read the first paragraph or two. In the weeks and months before President Biden's politically devastating performance on the debate stage in Atlanta, several current and former officials and others who encouraged him behind closed doors noticed that he increasingly appeared confused or listless or would lose the thread of conversations. Like many people his age, Biden, 81, has long experienced instances in which he mangled a sentence, forgot a name or two, or mixed up a few facts, even though he could be sharp and engaged most of the time. But in interviews, people in the room with him more recently said those lapses seemed to be growing more frequent and more pronounced and, yes, more worrisome. The uncomfortable occurrences were not predictable, but seemed more likely when he was in a large crowd or tired after a particularly bruising schedule. In the 23 days leading up to the debate, Mr. Biden jetted across the Atlantic Ocean twice for meetings with foreign leaders and then flew from Italy to California for a fundraiser, maintaining a grueling pace that exhausted even much younger aides. It should be noted the Biden campaign, I think it should be noted that the Biden campaign came out yesterday and said that part of the reason was for the debate performance was because of the grueling travel schedule. It should also be pointed out that he had been home for, I believe, 9 days after that, and was also at Camp David for a good deal of the time during the prep. So that does bring that up. Also, this story, the Biden response to this of I was traveling, that made me tired. Mm-hmm. I almost fell asleep on stage. That may or may not have been a joke. I think it was supposed to be a joke. Don't make a joke.
Yeah.
No. So I don't think, because now that is the headline and pretty much well, maybe not every newspaper, but a lot of websites have that as the, you know, I almost fell asleep on stage, which it angers me because my heart was ready to explode while he was on stage. So I don't know. Again, I think it was a joke, but I don't think that's something you joke about when you're trying to prove to people that you have the stamina. And this is, I guess, what I ultimately want to talk to the panel about. If you don't have the stamina, then and you keep on saying, well, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, I don't have the stamina. I went, I traveled, I did all of these things. And now, but this guy is horrible. This Trump guy is horrible and an existential threat. And by the way, I'm going to be the one who runs against him.
Yeah. Because these are all responsibilities that we expect the president to be able to do. Right, Joe? I mean, this is what you're saying. You have to be able to travel. You've got to be able to meet with world leaders. You got to be able to represent the country. It's baseline.
Right. I mean, the common refrain is when you, and this came from out of a debate many years ago, but, you know, if they wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning, are you ready to take the call?
Yeah.
In this case, if you get the call at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, are you napping?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the press has come under a lot of criticism in the last 6 months for what people said was over-focusing on Biden's age. You heard that again and again, especially the New York Times took a lot of criticism for it. And in retrospect, maybe the mainstream media wasn't paying enough attention or wasn't giving serious consideration to these reports that he was strained. He was not paying attention, that he was, you know, I think we would paint the right-wing media as just exaggerating the fact that he couldn't walk up and down stairs very quickly. Again, I don't think that's a big deal, mm-hmm. but I think whether or not he can focus enough to get through a meeting is important. The right wing is criticizing continues to criticize the mainstream media for missing that. And then you're getting reports from the left wing media or the left that the media now is trying to bring Joe Biden down. I mean, who sent that order out? That's just not true.
And you know, when you think about it, I think it started when sort of some of the reporting came out early on during the Trump presidency as well. I mean, he was basically watching TV for 3 hours a day or more, right? He didn't actually do his job, and that took a long time to come out. And then it was also discussed in different ways, you know, is it appropriate, inappropriate, depending on where the media was leaning. So this has been a pattern for actually a decade, I think, that it's not been disclosed, or longer with prior presidents not disclosing.
FDR, we ignored JFK, and we didn't do that, and we should have. And at this point, Joe Biden should be out there doing press conferences. He should be doing town halls.
Constantly,
he should be
right?
all the time.
Well, and that was one of the points that came up. We had the first Democrat elected came out, and this guy either is going to be end up being a secretary of a department or a bus driver. I don't know which, but Representative Doggett, correct, from Texas,
yeah.
Came out yesterday and said it's time to go. And yeah. and while people have been saying this quietly, he is starting that amongst. Now he is not a high profile member of Congress. He does represent a portion of the state of Texas, but there are others who are saying it more loudly. Mm-hmm. I was a bit surprised by what. By what Nancy Pelosi said yesterday, of at least admitting mm-hmm. that this is a real issue and something that we need to discuss.
Yeah, I think the faucets are opening up here. I think it's just the beginning trickle, but it'll happen. There will be increasing conversation about this because it is really irresponsible to have someone who may not be able to, you know, we said earlier, the three of us, before you walked into the room, Joe, we were talking about, can you imagine Biden by himself meeting with Putin? And, you know, that's just the scary thought. And we can't have a president that we can't rely on to be alert enough to be not schnookered, to be confused or something like that. It's really a frightening moment, and we have to reflect on what the future for this country might look like.
And it's a frightening moment, particularly because the Supreme Court has given absolute immunity mm-hmm. to a president. And we know that we have a potential president who will abuse that authority in every sense of the word. And if
can I scope out on that just for a second?
Sure, please.
Which is, what if you give a president who is compromised, and I'm not saying we don't know if mm-hmm. he is or not, but this president, those same powers?
Well, that's just it. The Supreme Court has fundamentally changed, in my mind, how I think about the presidency. You know, it's an interesting day. It's July 3rd, and, you know, I start to think mm-hmm. about what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be American? Mm-hmm. I always thought, you know, it was a country of laws. It was a country where we're equal under the law. And the Supreme Court just has absolutely thrown that away. With the Biden situation, mm-hmm. though, and if you know, Biden needs to do what's right for the country, not what's right for Biden or Biden's family or his closest advisors. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that him stepping aside would cement a legacy in a ways that him continuing to push on despite everything that we see isn't going to do. He's been a really successful president. He doesn't get credit for it. I think the way he's handled the economy, the post-COVID, international affairs, the legislation he's passed, he's been a successful president. I think if he continues to push on, the legacy is going to be that he returned the presidency to one of the most corrupt dictators that we will have ever faced in this country.
I just want to read one paragraph from the New York Times article that I referenced earlier. By necessity, it is an incomplete picture. As Mr. Biden has aged, the White House has limited his encounters with reporters. While he frequently stops for a minute or two to answer a question, as of Sunday, Mr. Biden had granted fewer interviews than any president of the modern era and fewer news conferences than any since Ronald Reagan, according to statistics compiled by Martha Kumar, a longtime scholar of presidential communication. On the occasions that Mr. Biden has chosen to speak with reporters on short notice, it has not always gone well. And just one more point that I think is interesting and important for us to take into account, if I can find it, which is that there is the White House regularly releases corrected transcripts of his remarks in which he frequently mixes up places, people, or dates. The administration did so in the days after the debate when Mr. Biden mixed up the countries of France and Italy when talking about war veterans and an East Hampton fundraiser. That may seem petty, and I don't think in and of itself it's especially alarming. Anyone who has that kind of schedule, I think any one of us in this room could possibly do the same thing. And when something goes out, you want to look at it and say, I know personally, I will turn to people. I will turn to Mike Bowen, our wonderful engineer, and say, I'm sorry, what did I just say on the air? So there is that. I understand that. But in the totality of everything, I think it becomes more weighty.
If it's a daily experience that you can't recall something or you get very tired or you get confused, that's really worrisome. And I think that's what we're beginning to see here, because he cannot, you know, he used to not be able to speak with the media unless he was prepared and practiced, but now the practice seems to also not work. So it's a further deterioration of his condition. And it might just be part of the aging process. I mean, we all have these lapses, as Joe said, because of exhaustion or medication or age. But that's reality. And we don't need a United States that begins to look like, you know, in our early conversation, we talked about the Soviet Union, where you had octogenarians running the show, and you never knew if they actually were making decisions or if sort of the shadow staff was deciding where the country was going. And I think I begin to worry that the shadow staff around Biden is making decisions and choices and guarding him and protecting him in a way that is now becoming more evident, it appears.
I will leave with this, and then we'll take a break and come back and continue our conversation. But in the cable news coverage that I was watching last night, they were doing a story about Hurricane Beryl. And at one point, they said that the White House is monitoring the situation. And the anchor, coming back to the anchor says, you know, there's a time when I knew what that means. Right now, I don't know exactly what that encompasses of the White House monitoring a situation. The one thing I guess I'll ask you, Judy, to start, and then, of course, anyone can jump in. You alluded to this fact, but tomorrow will be 1 week since the debate, and we're still discussing this. And I don't think that's our fault, meaning the media. Because this story has not gone away, and the strangeness of the Biden response, meaning that everything's fine, just had a bad night, we're you know, this is, anyone who's ever been in a room with him knows how great he is, and yet we're not going to put him out. He had no major schedule over the past 7 days. He went out and talked to the American people for a few moments on Monday night. He had the opportunity to take questions. He didn't take questions. There have been several opportunities to take long-form live interviews, and the White House has not taken those. The White House has refused to make his medical records available or to have a press conference with his doctor. And finally, we hear that he will have an interview with George Stephanopoulos that will air on the 7th, which I think is going to take place on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know how you look at it. To me, it seems like a really bad situation. B, one that this administration doesn't seem to have a really good handle on 1 week out.
Right. Diehard Biden loyalists are trying to kill the story with messages that it was a one-time event. There's nothing to see here, when, in fact, 52 million Americans saw with their own eyes how Joe Biden reacted during that debate. That is incontrovertible. No amount of spin is going to make that go away. And certainly what might have made it go away, although, man, I think that performance is really hard to erase no matter what he had done. But if he'd been out there the next day taking up, or even that night, taking real questions from real reporters, he's never done a full-length interview with anyone from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the major newspapers. He's never sat down and had a hard interview. And let me be clear, one of the bedrock principles of our democracy is transparency and open government. And the White House, the apparatus around the president have shielded him and have prevented us from knowing what the public really has had a right to know.
I understand people who will write to us and say that we're bashing the president. I get it. I understand it. But by the same token, And I don't want to be seen, because I do think that everyone, I mean, at least everyone in this room and mm-hmm. most people who are Democrats who are don't take any glee or joy in this.
No.
It's very sad. It's a sad mm-hmm. situation. However, I am surprised by if, correct me if I'm wrong, folks, but if we were in a quote unquote normal administration where you have a bad, because they keep on comparing this to Obama's bad performance. Okay. Not the same.
No.
Not the same. No. The 2011 performance with Mitt Romney, not the same.
No.
However, the moment after that, Obama was everywhere. He right. was on television. He was doing interviews. He was doing events. He was doing press conferences. He was everywhere. And that has not happened here.
No.
So I can't believe that they don't think that's a good idea. It's that they realize doing it
Might make it worse.
Well, yeah. It will make it worse.
Well,
and
I don't
clear
know.
He can't do it. That's why he's not doing it.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, that's what you're left with. And if yeah. that's not true, then go and prove it to us. And I do think, does anyone disagree that if he has just a, I'll use this term, a kick-ass interview with George Stephanopoulos, that people are going to suddenly turn and say, oh, okay, everything's fine?
No, and go back to the Obama. I think the Obama example is really interesting, because what Obama did, though, is that he came right back out swinging. He started to talk about how crazy Palin was, the vice president nominee, how dangerous Romney's policies were. Now, dangerous considering where the hard right is now compared to where Romney is, it looks
danger of old.
Oh yeah, I'll take that danger. You know, he was back on the campaign trail. Right now, it feels to me, and it's grim. You know, Joe, I'll admit, I think this is really grim that Biden's advisors are out of ideas. They don't know how to deal with this, so they're going to pretend that it doesn't exist. You're right. We saw it the same way I saw January 6th, and I will never forgive Trump for January 6th. Mm-hmm. I saw the debate. I saw what I saw, and I don't have faith in Joe Biden's ability right now to handle 4 more years of the type of leadership the country needs. And again, I'm gonna go back and say it's about the country. It's about what's right for all of us, and this is where I think Biden stepping back is the right thing for the country.
Under normal circumstances, if it wasn't an election year, you know, his team could probably manage him and handle it. But we're extremely worried now, because what we see is the potential for a Trump presidency, which is clearly going in the direction of a Viktor Orban in Hungary, which, you know, I mean, Viktor Orban used very similar. He's been in power for 14 years, reelected based on false promises, lies, putting his finger on the scale of the justice system, appointing judges, making sure the judiciary is not independent anymore. When we look at the developments in Hungary, we can see certain patterns in this country. Restrictions on media freedoms, arrests of journalists, you know, propaganda usage in various ways on behalf of Viktor Orban. I see a similar path for us that I'm extremely worried about, and that is my main concern. I really liked Biden's policies over the past several years. I think he's done a good job. He hasn't gotten enough credit. But if the man wants to go down in the history book as somebody who righted the ship.
Vera Carius-Kelly on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 3rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org and are also available in the WAMC app or wherever you find your podcasts. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.